I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today I'm joined by European tour player Richie Ramsey. Richie is the former U.S. amateur champion, a three-time winner on the European tour, and burgeoning golf course architecture nut. Richie, welcome on.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, for sure. It's always exciting to talk to guys that can talk about, you know, competitive golf and playing golf at the highest level, but also architecture.
Oh, yeah. It's been playing golf for a long, long time now since I was a little kid. And fortunate to travel to some far-flung places and experience a lot of different courses and cultures and stuff. So definitely got a fresh look at some architecture and with a lot of travels on the European tour and obviously coming from Britain, got a pretty traditional aspect of it mixed in there. So yeah, that's kind of my new thing at the moment is learning a bit more about the great designers and what drove them and their skill set and how it's developed over the last probably 80 or 90 years.
Yeah, and then in your case, where you grew up, I mean, over the last 200 plus years, or no?
Oh yeah,
100. And,
yeah, long, yeah, long time.
I can't do that math. So Richie, why don't you give our listeners a little bit of background? How'd you get into golf and just kind of your story?
All right, I'll try and. I tend to rabble a bit, which I'll try and cut it as quickly as I can do it with a little timeline. So basically, yeah, I started golf when I was a little kid, hitting plastic balls and plastic clubs in the back garden. But like any Scottish kid or most Scottish kids, I wanted to play football, so soccer, not American football. When I was younger, and by the time I got to about 13 or 14, I started to realize that I was decent at football, but I was never great, and I was far better at golf. And it was my grandfather who got me into it. He used to take me to the nine-holer, cut down clubs and wrap tape around them. Like, you just buy tape in a tennis shop or something, any kind of tape, just wrap it around. He used to take me up. I remember the Volvo he used to drive. It was like a tank. It would knock anything else off the road.
It was like the most safe car ever built.
Yeah, he would drive it pretty ruthlessly. It wasn't too many indicators or too many looks. It was just foot down at the floor, which was quite amusing. But yeah, he was a huge influence on me, and he was an ex RAF serviceman, and he was a head teacher at school, so he had quite a strong sense of direction. And it wasn't until after he passed away that I realized he was actually he had an MBE, which is a member of the British Empire, I think, which is you get that bestowed on you by the Queen. So yeah, I sort of, I had a huge amount of respect for my grandfather when he was alive, but even more so after he passed, because I started to realize and research a bit about him. So he was the biggest influence on me. So yeah, 15, started playing some tournaments, and I finished second to my good friend now, George Murray at under 16s Scottish Stroke, then realised, you know, maybe there's a future in this for me, because I played well, but I only lost by a shot, and I felt that I could have won. So then, you know, travelled the world, played under 18, under 21, played for Europe and New Zealand, played all around the world, played Japan, anywhere you can imagine, South Africa, Eisenhower Trophy, and played Walker Cup 2005, and had a spell in America for a year on a golf scholarship, came back around about that time, and I had 4 years at university in Stirling, got a degree there. 2006 I won the US Amateur, and after that I finished my degree, and then 2007 turned pro and with a degree in my pocket, and kind of gave it a shot, and from then I feel like I progressed through the Challenge Tour after a couple of years, and I've been on the main tour since 2009. Mm-hmm. So won three times, South African Open, Amiga European Masters, and the Hassan Trophy too, which is in Morocco. So
you're a global winner.
Yeah, I've managed to chalk up a few all over the place, and I suppose that's the. It's not. It says it's a European tour, but we're as a global a tour as you're going to get without playing in North America really, or South America, so everywhere else we pretty much go to, and lots of air miles, lots of airports.
I wonder how many guys have won on like six continents, because you could win in Africa, Europe, Asia, Australia, and then the US. That'd be pretty incredible.
Oh yeah, I mean, the last four tournaments I played in 2017 were on four different continents, week after week.
It's crazy. It definitely is turning into a world tour. Obviously, air travel has made it a lot easier. Kind of going back to when you turned pro, you played as an amateur in the Masters, the U.S. Open, and the Open Championship, and I know that year was a Walker Cup year. Did you put much thought into staying am and playing in the Walker Cup for a second time?
You know what? I thought about it, and I didn't know really until about the start of the summer. And I really thought to myself, there were three reasons for it. I'm quite a logical guy, and I like to, you know, me and my coach talk it through, and if he asks me a question, he knows that I can always validate the answer. So the sort of three reasons behind it were, one, that I just felt it was time. I felt I was plateauing out and I wanted to push myself a little bit more. I had already played the Walker Cup, so I'd already had that experience. Two was that all the other guys who were playing the Walker Cup, it was a strong GBI team. And when that Walker Cup was over, they'd all be looking for invites to tournaments. And if I turned pro before that, I would have far greater access to invites. Mm-hmm. So that was the way I was thinking, just to get myself starts in tournaments. And three, can I remember the third one? I don't know if I can. There was a third one, but I can't remember it. So it was kind of gut feeling, but the way things were lined up for me, I felt that it was the best to just to turn pro at that time and try and get a foothold on one of the pro tours, and that's what you really have to do. The two things, I discussed it the other day with someone, when you turn pro, are really, you have to find somewhere to play, and it helps if it's a good competitive tour like Challenge Tour, Web.com, or obviously the main tours. And you have to have money to play on those tours. Mm-hmm. So those are your two main things, I think, really, to accomplish.
Yeah, you've seen a couple kids from the States turn pro after their first semester this year, and the logic behind it, and it makes a lot of sense, is like, you know, these kids turn pro after they graduate or after their school year, but then there aren't enough tournaments to get starts in to fill your, you know, 7 or 8 sponsors exemptions while, you know, by the end of the year because of the way it's laid out.
Yeah, I'm surprised that this day and age, some of the decisions I see people make are, I don't really understand them. I totally get everybody's individual, and I'm a massive believer in that, because in myself, I'm quite individual in the way I approach stuff and the way I look at things and what I believe in. But I sometimes think people make decisions and almost make it harder for themselves, and it's a hard enough task as it is to get a foothold in the professional tour. So whatever you do has to be thought through, you know, have a mentor, your coach, or someone from outside look at it and maybe throw up a few other issues with it, and hopefully you can come to a solid decision and one that gives you the best chance to progress in the game.
Yeah, it's almost like you got to maximize your chances, because that's almost what it's such a crazy sport. Like, it's the difference between it and, say, like, you know, American like football or American basketball, or I imagine soccer. Like, when you're playing on a lower tier team, you get a salary, you get your food paid for, your travel paid for, but in golf, it's all on you. It's all performance.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's all on you. And I think it's, you know, it can be hard because the way the media present a lot of the guys who come through, it's kind of like, oh, he just turned pro and then he got a foothold, and, well, look at John Rahm, he did it and he turned pro, and you know, he's a multiple winner now and whatever, top 5 in the world, and McIlroy did it. And I was like, but for every one, you know, there's tens of thousands, maybe if not hundreds of thousands, who don't make it. These are exceptions to the rule. These are, I mean, McIlroy, I would say he's a one, he's not even a one in a decade player. He's a player that comes along every...
He's like a generational guy.
Well, I would say at least every 50 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amount of talent, the sheer talent he has, I think there's only, in my mind, there's only, I haven't played with every single person, but there'd be, you'd have this, you know, one hand to count, and other people have the same amount of talent he does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's close to him. That's not even probably the amount he has. It's just one person.
Well, I think back to my junior golf days, and a name that now he's really having a lot of success is Brian Harman. But as a junior, I mean, he absolutely dominated golf. I mean, he was a 2-time Walker Cup player, probably one of the best junior golfers of all time. And now at age 31, he's, you know, really starting to become an elite American player. But it takes time for a lot of guys. It's so rare to have someone like Spieth or someone like McIlroy have such success before they're 24.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I think guys just turn pro younger these days as well. I don't know why the reasoning behind that. Maybe I think they see, you know, the lifestyle and think, you know, I want that. I don't want to go to university. They just want it and go for it early out of the gates. You know, funny enough, I played against Brian Harman in the Walker Cup. He's obviously a great talent, very natural player, good belief in himself. And I think I won one against him and lost one, but the guy who was the most talented, and he's in the top 5 most talented guys I've ever played with, and we played against him, was Anthony Kim. Mm-hmm. He was the real deal. He was just, you know, drove it well, pretty long, good iron player, great natural ability to shape shots, aggressive, good putter just wasn't a weakness in his game. You know, he still to this day was like, I mean, he could have won majors, I think. Yeah. Multiple majors. No doubt about it.
It's definitely one of the sadder stories of golf. In terms, was there anybody like, you know, just out of this world talent that you've seen that's given up on the game, like that you grew up playing against?
trying to think, he was not really. I think he was the one guy who always stood out to me, and people will ask me who's the most talented guys you've ever played with. Well, I've been fortunate to play with Tiger, who's obviously immensely talented. Rory and Sergio I'd put in the same bracket, very close to each other. But for someone who doesn't even play now, Anthony was the one who stood out. And just, yeah, it's a real shame that it just, you know, I don't know the reasons, but it just didn't come to fruition and work out, because he was just so naturally, just looked so naturally talented. And it was one of those guys you were like, yeah, I'd pay to watch him, because he's legit, you know, he gets the job done.
I'm waiting for Anthony Kim to get his amateur status back and start becoming a menace on the mid-am circuit in America. It'd be worst nightmare.
Yeah, he could. I think he would enjoy that. Playing in a golf cart and a few drinks, he'd be all right at that.
Yeah, cocktail tour would be shook from Anthony Kim revival. You meant it, like, how is your perception of golf and like competition changed over the years?
I would say there's just a lot more people who don't give up as much, and what I mean by that is there's far more people who are committed, you know, who do the right things, who you know, go to the gym, make sure they stretch, have a physio, you know, go out and practice, dedicated, disciplined, you know, play aggressive. Definitely, unfortunately, I would say there's more not one-dimensional players, but just longer hitters who can dominate golf courses with length. And it's, you know, they're not playing the same golf course I am. It's simple as that. Mm-hmm. But that happens not every week, but some weeks. And yeah, just overall, the competition is stronger and it's deeper at the same time. So yeah, the level of commitment of players has gone up. I think the distance, the more guys, you know, who just flat out just bomb it, rather than you see them really working the ball and shaping shots. Mm-hmm. And also just the strength and depth.
Yeah, I noticed that. I was at the BMW this year and I was watching Rory play with Ollie Schneiderjans. And Ollie was hitting it like right up even with Rory all day pretty much. And I thought back and I'm like, God, you know, like, seven, eight years ago, Rory was like 20 yards past everybody.
Yeah, there's just, everybody's bigger. You know, there's a lot more guys who are bigger on tour who really have got a club head speed, and that really makes a difference. And it's the way it's going. And I kind of feel it's a little bit of a shame, because that's how some of the new courses build it, and it actually gives more of an advantage. You know, I love I always love the line, oh, we're tiger proofing Augusta. Mm-hmm. Well, you're just playing, what you're doing is you're playing into its hands and taking it away from the guys who are the bigger hitters. If you want to tiger proof it, you narrow the fairways at 300 yards or put bunkers further down, you know, make it so it's narrower and tighter. And it shows, you can tell golf courses you play, which are, you know, look at Hilton Head. I mean, look at the guys who do well there. You know, Kuchar, Luke Donald, GMAC, can't remember all of them, but I mean, look, you know, they're up there, they can work the ball, move the ball, real shot makers, straight off the tee, tidy short games, good tactical awareness of getting the ball around the golf course. You never, I mean, when do you ever see a guy who stands up and bombs it and do well around there?
It's not really. Not often. As I had Bill Coore on, and he was talking about Trinity Forest, the course he designed, and he talked about the idea of making courses shorter and wider because it forces players to, you know, not only hit the ball straight, but they have to pick a line and hit it the right distance as opposed to just hitting it straight, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot what Harbortown is. Do you kind of schedule your events with that in mind?
Oh yeah, there's definitely places that you know I look at and I think I can win there, definitely. Mm-hmm. No doubt about it. And there's some places that I look at and I think I could win there, but I still need to play really, really well to finish top 10, because it gives some guys a huge advantage and doesn't punish them where I think it should do. Like, where I'm trying to think of somewhere like a lot of cool golf courses in China really favor the guys who move it. We used to play a cool golf course there called Lake Malarin, and it was really bomber central soft, and if you could shift it, it made a big difference. But then you flip that and you put me around Valderrama. Now that's just like a tunnel most holes, and I love that. I could play golf there every day for the rest of my life and I'd be a happy man. But some people absolutely hate it because it's narrow, you have to move it, there's a bit of wind, and it really is like, you know, you come off there and you shoot under par, and you know, you give yourself a pat on the back because that's a hell of a round of golf.
Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, Valderrama had what was it two years ago, Beef won shooting over par, right, for the four rounds.
Yeah, I played with him in a couple of those rounds, I think, and it was very tricky. It was strong wind, and obviously the greens are quite fast, and they're quite small targets, and the rough at the side of the greens was absolutely brutal. Like if you missed it by 2 yards inside the green, you could, you know, I remember having one, and I was like, there was one round where I was off the green by less than 3 yards, and every single time I was chipping away from the pin because I couldn't go at it because it was, I couldn't control it, and it was so quick that I'd be chipping off the other side. So that was just really tough conditions, but it is a phenomenal golf course, and it just makes you think, and you have to think about all the shots, you know, sometimes hitting, you know, like the first hole, really, really spinny green, you stand there and you get the wind into, which you know is above the trees. But if you don't have that nine iron that you can hit 110 yards, you can't control the ball. So that's something you got to have. It's a lot less one-dimensional than I say some of the modern golf courses are.
So it kind of brings up an interesting point. With the difference, you know, playing in Europe and on the European tour, you play obviously all over the world. How big of an adjustment is it going, you know, from playing golf in, say, you know, the British Isles, to these different parts of the world?
Well, it's a massive adjustment. It used to be, you know, I argue to a lot of people, it used to be to our advantage because we generally used to play in Europe. So yeah, time difference was helping us. The type of courses, the type of grass, the temperature. But these days it actually goes the opposite way. It probably favors a lot of the guys who play abroad more. I mean, it's just not the same type of golf. You know, you play a lot more golf along the ground. There's far more wind, so your ball flight needs to be stronger and it needs to be more penetrating. You don't just stand up and hit it up in the sky and drop it down. Around the greens is dramatically more different from the fact that, you know, you're keeping it on the ground, you're putting a lot more, you're not playing these sort of flop shots as much, mm-hmm. from thick rough. But then, you know, in the summer, our greens are a lot firmer, but they're generally slower than the ones on tour. So, you know, you take that. We have, I mean, I think we have a major problem in Scotland with just simple facts of life, which are, if you want to win a tournament on the PGA Tour or the European Tour, and you look at putts gained, whatever number that is, I'm guessing it's roughly about 3-3.5 per round. Mm-hmm. But we don't have greens that we can practice on consistently, so we can go out and tour and compete. So my argument's always been backed up by the data, and the data shows that, like, the most important thing about winning a golf tournament, you've got to ball strike it, and a lot of Scottish guys do, because you can't play a links golf without being a pretty good ball striker.
Yeah, the wind eats it up.
Yeah, but fundamentally, you've got to putt well, and if you don't have that, there are some weeks you can get very close, but most weeks you're going to have to putt well to win, and we don't have the facilities that match in with what the data suggests you need to be a winner. So
I saw you were in the States, your wife is American, and you were practicing at Hazeltine in Minnesota over the holidays. Is that the type of setup that you're talking about?
Yeah, something along those lines. I mean, we have a couple of indoor facilities in Scotland. I haven't been. Some of them are private. One of them has just recently opened that I haven't been to yet, other than the chance. But the facility at Hazeltine is, I mean, it's got a putting green indoor in the basement that's probably 25, 30 feet by about 20 feet. So great for practicing your putting, working on a skill, effectively, and trying to enhance a skill on a consistent green that's similar pace to the tour, a little bit of slope in it, and you don't have all these variables, which are, you know, bumps in the green, wind especially is a major thing for us, and just a consistent surface to putt on. Mm-hmm. So you can work on and try and improve your putting that way, and I think that's something that we hopefully can address in the near future. I understand there's facilities at Northwestern and a lot of the northern colleges that help them out in the winter. I've seen some facilities there which look incredible.
Yeah. So you were a part of, like, the Scottish golf, the, like, performance program when you were an amateur, correct?
Yeah, I was from almost age 15. I was in the what we call the Scottish squads, and progressed through what was the Scottish Golf Union, which now is just called Scottish Golf, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So, like, they pick up your, like, travel expenses, tournament entry fees, and then, like, coaching fees? Is that how it kind of works?
What happens is they pay for some of your expenses, not all of them, but once you're, like, a full squad member of the Scotland setup, then you get reasonable expenses, so you still have to put in money of your own to go away and play tournaments, but they assist you with that, and then the major thing is providing help with resources like strength and conditioning, physio, coaching if needed. So you may have your own coach that you work with. He may come to the squad sessions, and they will liaise and work on that. But over the last, say, 10 years, it's changed a lot for the better. So it's really, really good now. And the guys have a great structure behind them and a great performance setup. But with anything, it can always get better.
Mm-hmm. How would you compare, and obviously you never were a part of it, but compare it to like I know England has it, Ireland has it, Australia has it. Are they all pretty comparable, or is there one that kind of stands out?
I would say it's funny. I think I would split it into two. I would split it into your job is to sort of produce great amateur and great amateur teams, and I think we've done a really good job of that. We've always had a good success rate of in amateur golf, especially with our team performances. If you look at us winning European Championships, when I played home internationals, we really played well and almost dominated for about 3 years, which is England, Ireland, Wales, and Scotland play every year. We did well in the Europeans. We did pretty good in the Eisenhower. Not great, but I think top 10. But the problem is for one reason or another, we struggled to produce really good professionals in the last maybe 7 or 8 years. Whereas, you know, we're level pegging with England the amateur, but then when it comes to professional, they seem to produce a lot more professionals who make it to a higher level. But they have a population of 55 million and far more people playing golf. So it's not like for like, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I've always wondered why the States don't have it, but it could just be, it's just so big, you know?
I think it's so big, and the university is, like, the university budgets outweigh what the Scottish golf budget would be.
Yeah.
I mean, tenfold easily.
That makes a lot of sense.
Like, I hear stories that are just, to me, are just incredible. Like, I think this might be a mistake, but roughly speaking, I think Georgia Tech, I believe, were, because I used to live in Atlanta at the time, were looking for a new practice facility, and they built a new one downtown in Atlanta. And they had to obviously purchase the land, they had to build a clubhouse, turf it, do everything with it. I think it cost $13 million to do that.
Yeah, I think Illinois built one that was like 8 or 9 million on campus. It's crazy, and it's like these kids go to school and they can hit on a range that has every different type of grass, kind of like what you were talking to. They can practice putting on Bermuda grass even though they're in Illinois.
Yeah, I mean that to me is unbelievable. The resources they have to do that, the vision they have to do it is pretty impressive. But what I would say is it's really important to have good resources, but even I fell into this trap is that when I was in Scotland, I was far more hardened to traveling, playing in tough conditions. So then when I got to like a nice country club, I'd be like, oh, this is unbelievable. Look at this. Look, there's new Pro V1s in the range. Like, you know, this is, we're putting off turf instead of off mats. There's no wind. You know, the greens are running at like 10 and a half. This is incredible. Whereas sometimes you can build up these great facilities. But if I was a coach, yeah, I'd let them practice the facility. But one day a week, I'd take them to the worst place, worst golf course in wherever they were and make them play. And I want to see them hit it out of like rubbish lies, putting greens that aren't that great, deal with conditions and see how their attitude develops over that day and see how they work with that. Because when you have everything at your disposal, it's only going to get worse from there, because it's not all 100% first class facilities everywhere you go. especially when you're starting out in professional golf.
Like the Challenge Tour, I bet you probably played a lot of places that were suspect at best on conditioning.
Yeah, I mean, Challenge Tour's got a lot of good courses, and it's a great tour to build off. But when I played, you know, sometimes there wasn't a driving range. You know, you're just hitting a net, and then you teed off on the first. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got to deal with that. And you have to, and then you go and play, you know, qualifying school, and, you know, say the weather hasn't been great and the golf course isn't in great condition, you've got to deal with that. And I think I'm a big believer that adversity makes you very strong, and it's not in the peaks that we build our character, it's in the troughs. And when you're down in the sort of trenches, that's where you build your character and your belief and your determination, your motivation, which will see you get to the top. And when you're at the top, you need to remember that.
Yeah, I think golf is a different sport in the sense that, like, you almost learn more when you fail, like when you get in a moment and you fail, because then the next time you remember that and you might think differently, right?
Oh, yeah, we've all been there, you know. Especially in professional golf, you walk off and you do question yourself. Even the top players, I'm sure they question themselves. Is this what I want to be doing? Is this, sometimes it feels like it's torture, you know?
Yeah.
But there's a, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and I think you need to have good people around you really to support you and be a positive impact and pick you up when times are down. That's something that I have, and it's something that's a major. I'm not saying I've been an incredible player, but the success that I've had is attributed to people that are there for me when I ultimately need them. Because, you know, everybody, maybe from the outside, it looks great. You know, these guys, you know, top players in the world, you know, making millions and flying on private jets and, you know, holidaying in the Bahamas and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But, you know, just like in everybody's life, you know, you get these times where they can be pretty hard, and you've got to have those people around you which provide a safety net and pick you up when you're feeling down.
Mm-hmm. So with it being kind of a new year, how do you... in new season for you, is it, do you just kind of keep rolling from season to season, or do you have a kind of new season structure, or like have a mentality to approach it?
Well, I try and clock out. I was very much a guy who would be off season. I would just keep going. I'd keep practicing, keep working on it. But I've realized it's different now. I've got a family, you know, I spend time with them, but I really sort of hold myself off and get away from it as much as possible in order that when I come back, I'm refreshed, I'm ready to go. Because it's not always the time that you're playing. Sometimes the most important time is a rest period. You know, I analyze the year, think about what I did well, think about what I didn't do well, I test equipment. Like to settle on equipment before I tee up in the first tournament. Just think about scheduling. Try and do a lot of like advance work so that when I'm at the tournament, I just need to focus on that tournament and come into it fresh and but at the same time still sharp. That's why I go to Dubai early doors to get good practice. And just be, you know, sounds a little bit cliched, but, you know, attitude of number one, train like you're number two.
Mm-hmm. That's a good mentality to have. You got to have confidence in this game. That's for sure.
Yeah. And Scottish confidence is like pessimism, really, to be honest. It's not... Scots have never been shouting from the rooftops, and if you do, you get dragged down pretty quick. So, Yeah, I'm a, what I do admire about a lot of Americans, a lot of young Americans, is they really are confident and aggressive, and they play with a, you know, a swagger about them. Even the people who are great ambassadors for the game, like Spieth, you know, he's got an edge in there. You know, you could see that with that putts on 15 Open last year. He's yeah. like, you pick that ball at the hole, you know, he's got that little edge that I like. That's, I really like that kind of style of player, confident, but a little kind of little edge to them, very, very strong in their belief that they know what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. In terms of scheduling, what do you think about like the unique formats that the European tour has been trying out in recent years?
I like the ideas. I think I honestly don't know if it's a game changer or not. I probably couldn't ask that question. What I do like about them is that they are being proactive in testing new formats of the game out in the professional game, trying to make it more appealing to, try to make the product more appealing to the general public, especially the younger generation. And just give them kudos. They're trying, you know. Yeah. We're not saying we're gonna turn things around, but they're definitely making people think, raising awareness, and instead of just standing there planning, they're actually executing and getting it done, which I think in the golf world, like, people talk so much and they just like, I'm just like, you know what? If you want something, you go out there and get it. Just get it done. Mm-hmm. Stop talking about it and get it done.
Yeah, I like the idea of changing up. Like the short matches was like a really cool. That was the Golf Sixes. Was
yeah,
really
the
cool.
Golf Sixes. Yeah,
and having it in a city, like it was in the heart of London, right?
Well, this is from my point of view. This is the one thing I would change. They had it at the Centurion Club, which is outside of London, and it's a very good golf course, a lovely facility, very, very good. But I'd have it as close to the city centre as possible. I'd have buses running, free buses running on loop from the city centre, you know, make it as easy as possible for people to be exposed to that tournament. And you know, you've really got these days, and the difference between America and, I would say, one of the big differences between America and Europe is that when you have a golf tournament, it's a social event, you know? Mm-hmm. You'll get guys who will say, you know, in the office, we work 9 to 5, say, oh, they've got that, what do you call that, that Phoenix Open going on, and they've got Tiesto playing, and I think I'll go on there for the day. I mean, I'm not into golf, but looks a good fun event. Whereas generally in Europe, it's, although there is some social aspects to it, it's generally more people who actually play golf and take a firm interest in golf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, the Phoenix one is like, I feel like it's a kind of an outlier, but for the mm-hmm. for the most part, like I know the Nelson is a big social event, and they do, it's so much with those corporate hospitalities that makes it, and hospitality tends to make it much more social on the American tour.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a little bit more that way in places like Dubai, Abu Dhabi, because there's, you know, people love coming to events, and it's a great, you know, the sun's on your back, and it's a great little walk in the green grass when there's desert around you. So a little bit more that way in, I would say, the new markets, but we have a lot of established markets, and it's probably more the other way with more golfers who come to the events.
So do you set, like, do you have goals for this year, or are you just kind of, you just try and play your best, and wherever it goes, it goes?
Well, my mission is kind of I always like to take the viewpoint that I kind of got to be the best I can be. So effectively, don't worry about Rory McIlroy or Jordan Spieth. I just got to be the sort of the best Richie Ramsey I can be. And I try and do all the things I can do every week to do that. And if I miss a cut and I walk away, I walk away with my head held high. But at the same time, if I finish second, I walk away with my head held high. So, I really want to get back in the winner's circle, because effectively, there's nothing better than winning, let's be honest. Race Dubai is obviously a big thing. You always want to be in that season-ending tournament in Dubai, and get a little bit more feel for, playing in those WGCs and those major tournaments, because I played in the US Open this year, and I feel a lot more comfortable playing in them, and I feel that I played good at the Open this year. Fourth last group on the Saturday, but I feel like I've got a little bit more in the tank to show. I didn't quite finish it off.
Yeah, you're right in the thick of it heading into the weekend, which is, the major championships, obviously. But to a certain extent, instead of overrated, underrated, are major championships overrated when discussing players' legacy?
That's a great question. That's a very good question. I would say no. I think it's the main determination of how good a player they are. The WGCs have an impact because the fields are so strong. I would love to see WGCs split differently. I'm a staunch believer that I know there's one in Mexico, but
yeah, it seems like there should be one at the home of golf.
There's one in Mexico, but let's be honest, for the lion's share of the last few years, there's been three in America and there's been one in China. And if you want to grow the game worldwide, you don't have three in America. But what's the reason they're there? It's because the sponsors put up the money, and they've got fantastic sponsors in America, and a large share of the best golfers in the world live there, so it's easy for them to get to tournaments and play there, which makes the fields great, which makes the sponsors happy, and brings excitement and a great product to the fans. So I don't blame them for putting there, but I think one of the founding things was that they should be, that they're all world golf events, they're not American golf events. So
that's yeah, I completely agree, especially when it's the World Golf Championships, and then you look at the golf courses they play, and they play Austin Country Club, which is like, it's a nice golf course, but this is a World Golf Championship. You play Firestone, same kind of idea, the Mexico course, and then they play in China at a brutal golf course there. But like, it's like, why aren't these hosted at like a great course in Australia, a great course in the British Isles, a great course in America, and obviously you hit it with sponsors, but like, that would be such a better product in my mind.
Yeah, I would love to see, and I've said this a lot, is I'm not saying, you have to have, basically, you have to have the sponsors, you have to have the money to put it there, right? But I would love to see a world golf event in Ireland. Now, I love Scotland, and I am immensely proud to be Scottish, and I love playing here. I love living in Edinburgh, and everywhere I go, I carry the Saltire with me. But the atmosphere and the fans in Ireland are as good as it pretty much gets. And they, because the courses they have as well, and the players they have, talking about McIlroy and G-Mac, Darren, all those guys have added to it, Hynington. I think they generally deserve a world golf event. And the fans you would get and the hype would be incredible. And if you think about it, it's effectively one of the closest places to the US.
Yeah.
So it's not actually, you know, if you lived in, for the West Coast guys, but if you lived on the East Coast of America.
It's shorter from New York to Ireland than New York to LA.
Well, there you go. There's my point precisely. And I think the difference in the warmth, the atmosphere and stuff you would get would be incredible. And I genuinely think in the future that's the way you'd have it. You know, say you had the Irish Open one year in the north, have a World Golf event in the south. Okay, would it work? I think it would. I think, you know, Rory obviously does a hell of a job promoting the Irish Open, but you know, and it's a life experience for a lot of these guys. But I bet a lot of these guys haven't gone there and played, and maybe you could go over there with your family and play some nice golf courses, experience the hospitality you do in Ireland, which is first class. And like I say, let's be honest, logistically, it's one of the easiest ways you could do it.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, like, who would? And the interest would be so much higher. Like, how many more people are going to tune in to watch the WGC at Royal County Down versus Firestone?
Oh yeah, and you know you'd sell it out. There's no doubt. But the reason one of the reasons they're taking the Open back to Portrush is because when we had the Irish Open there, they sold out. The only time I think they've ever sold a European Tour event out, and the weather wasn't even that great. And it was an incredible atmosphere. Yeah, I know they've changed the golf course a bit, but I think that was one of the reasons they took it back there, and it's great to see that happen. But I definitely think that in the future is, I can't really see a major fault with it, if I was honest.
So we've gotten on to kind of courses in Ireland. What are your favorite courses and just generally the British Isles?
British Isles, always very tough because there's so many golf courses. And I would say, straight away, I would say, I haven't played them all.
So let's just say you got 10 rounds. How are you going to split up the 10 rounds?
Oh, right, okay. So this is right. 10 rounds is great, right?
So this is tough. You can do multiple at a course if you want to do multiple.
Okay. So what I would do would be... Okay, so you've got to have St. Andrews in there straight away because... Everybody goes on about it. It's a home of golf, but it's a magical place. And walking around there and just walking up 18 and playing 17 and hitting the tee shot at the first, there's something special. You can't put a price on it. You can't put it together. It has something that other places simply don't have. So it's a special place, and I would always try and get a game on there if you can. And it's very deceptive because it is actually a good golf course. It makes you think a lot more than you do the first time you play it. You've got to maybe play it a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Probably more so a course that I could play every day for a week is Muirfield. Muirfield is an incredible place. Golf course design wise, as probably as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shot making ability, fairness, condition, experience, you know, slopes, look, everything is just, it's a fantastic day out. Lunch is brilliant. The members are always great crack at. To have a big lunch and maybe a few glasses of wine and then play foursomes in the afternoon. That is a real golf day out. Number three, pretty tough, but these three all sit together and all for different reasons. I would say Turnberry, Birkdale and Loch Lomond. Turnberry because it's just a majestic place. great history, beautiful views. I haven't played the golf course since it's been redone, but I played the Open there once, and it's just a very, very good golf course, strong, and quite iconic in the Scottish West Coast. Birkdale, what a fantastic golf course that is. I mean, the views, a lot more like my home course of Rother Aberdeen, where you tee up on the dunes and you hit down into the valleys. The back nine, I mean, I'd say from 11 onwards, you know, 8 of the best finishing holes you'll ever find. Obviously got a lot of history there. And just a course that I love playing. Aesthetically, it looks great on the eye. Tests you the way you think around it, but at the same time, it's scoreable. You know, there's a score out there to be had. Loch Lomond, again, very similar to Muirfield. Experience-wise, incredible. Staff there are fantastic. Willie in the locker room, exceptional. Remembers your name, even though you've maybe not been there for 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. Service is first class. Ross Duhouse, one of the best clubhouses you'll ever see in your life, at a setting that is probably one of the most spectacular, not in the British Isles, but in probably the world. And a very underrated golf course that Tom Weisskopf designed. Mm-hmm. It's a joy to play there. Really is a just fantastic golf course. Where's that me up to? 1, 2, what is St. Andrews Muirfield?
I think 5, right?
5, yeah. Okay, I'm gonna put Sunningdale in there.
Yeah.
And you could play the new or the old. Both exceptional. You've got to what I would like to term laser beam it around there. If you hit it offline, you'll be buying more golf balls in the pro shop. no doubt about that. Great halfway house. Fantastic halfway house. Oh, I mean, leave 20 minutes to stuff your face in there. Sausages in a roll, smoked salmon. I'm sure the members have a couple of cheeky drinks as well. So that's a great little kind of touch. But again, fantastic golf course design. Old school greens that just sit into you. But plays quite firm and fast, especially in the summer.
Mm-hmm. Harry Colton, Willie Park there.
Well, just he doesn't really get much better than him. So I would say that would be class Sunningdale as one, and if you could play the old or the new, play 36 that day, and I'd a little bit like Muirfield, I'd play 18 in the morning, lunch, and then foursomes in the afternoon, because that's a tradition at Muirfield.
Okay.
So we're up to 6. Oh, God, we've got 4 left. This is tough. I'm trying to think of the open courses. I don't know where I'd put Carnoustie, but I feel that it's got to be in there. Mm-hmm. Just because it's as fair a test of golf as you will find, and it's always, irrespective of the wind, it's always a place you love to go to. The greens are immaculate, normally the best surfaces you'll putt on in Scotland, I would say. Muirfield are close, Nairn are very good, but Carnoustie tend to be exceptional. And the finish, I mean, what a finish that is. I mean, you always talk about winning tournaments and coming down the stretch and having a lot of pressure. Well, 16 is a tough hole. Mm-hmm. 17 is very tricky, but 18 is probably, I think, one of the toughest finishing holes, if not the toughest finishing hole you'll play. It's just... great place to play golf, and obviously a huge amount of history with the people who have won there.
Yeah, that's got to be a good course that sets up well for you.
It sets up well for me because I think it's a ball striker's golf course.
Yeah.
You can't fake it around there. You can't just go, oh, just putt well and I'll get away with it. You've got to really know where the misses are, stay out of the bunkers, and sometimes you've got to challenge the bunkers. I think you've just got to flat out play around there. No doubt about it. Can't fake it. And it'd be good to see how the best players in the world set up to it. It's definitely scoreable. It's definitely scoreable. But it's just a very, very fair golf course. I would put Royal Aberdeen, my home course, in there, especially the older course that we used to play when I was a junior, the original, more of the original design.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, I used to play it in the front nine. I used to go away and play all these different golf courses that people used to rant and rave about and speak on and say, this is a great golf course. And I used to come back and really just think, this place is just way better. Really great memories there, fantastic membership that have helped me and helped a lot of people progress their golf and progress, you know, off the course. And just a place that is close to me, and I'd love to go back. I'd love to go back there and play and try and enjoy the golf course and the traditions, because it's the seventh oldest club in the world. It's 1780 it was established, so some great traditions there, and just fortunate to be a member there.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've got two left. Dominated by Scottish golf courses.
Yeah, any more Heathland courses?
I haven't really played a Heathland course that I thought really stood out for me. I'm trying to think if there's a couple that there's a great one. Moortown is definitely something that I wouldn't include in my top 10, but it would be somewhere where I'd play.
That was Mackenzie's first design.
Yeah, it's in, I believe it's in Leeds, and it had the Ryder Cup in
a long time ago.
30s, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was Mackenzie's first design.
Yeah, there's a few courses up there that kind of fall off the radar. Just because of where they are. They're not down south, so they don't get written about too much. Mm-hmm.
And they aren't open courses.
Yeah. You know what? I haven't actually played a ton of golf courses in England that I've been blown away by. I might get some backlash for that. Go on.
Hey, you're being loyal to your country.
Yeah. Proud Scotsman. I would say Portrush has to be in there. I haven't played all these other ones that are far away, like Lahinch, Tralee, Waterville, and all these ones. And I would love to play there. I think County Down's good, but I just think Portrush is better. I think the design is better. I think the views are better. The golf course is more in front of you. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, being close to the town, it has that great atmosphere. And it'd be really interesting to see how the new holes bed in and how the guys perform at the Open in a few years' time.
Mm-hmm. Have you played Dornoch?
You know what? I haven't.
Yeah, you got to get it out there.
Played Dornoch. I've played Skibo, which is very good, but I haven't played Dornoch for, I don't know why I haven't played it. I just never ventured up there. This is going to sound really funny, but I'm notorious for falling asleep really quickly. So, bide with me for a minute. So, driving long distances can be tough for me, because sometimes I mean, the other day I was at Muirfield and I got up early and played, and we had lunch, beautiful lunch, stuffed, and I had to drive back, and I had to stop 10 miles down the road to get a coffee, because I said to the guy you were down with, I was like, I'm going to be like a nodding dog here, so I need to stop and get a coffee. So the courses that are, I mean, Dornoch's a long way north, so that's my only excuse for not playing it. I can't really drive that far without falling asleep.
Where's the weirdest place you've fallen asleep?
Oh God, where did I fall asleep? I remember in Argentina, I fell asleep on a moving bus. When I was standing, we were getting a Challenger event, and the bus was packed. I had to stand. I was that tired that I nearly fell over because I fell asleep standing up while the bus was moving, which was quite impressive.
You get in the wrong spot. I went to Argentina maybe 2 years ago with my wife, and I went for a run, and I got lost, and I ended up running like into like a bad neighborhood, and it was like one of the worst experiences of my life because I didn't have a phone that worked, and I don't speak Spanish, and I like was trying to, you know, figure out how to get back, and I ended up running like 15 miles. That day, so I got a good workout.
Oh, yeah, I bet you ran at a fair pace as well.
it was a brutal experience.
Yeah, I'm not
A bus in Argentina would be really tough to fall asleep on, though.
I fell asleep. I don't remember this because it was a night out. But someone said to me, I fell asleep in a club, and I was next to a speaker, but that was. That there was a few other variables that were involved in that. It wasn't just once you get a couple of drinks, you know what it's like.
What's the best course in Scotland that nobody knows about? Under the radar.
So just quickly before I answer that, the last one on the list, which is the best one on the list. That's slightly off the radar is a place called the Island, which is outside Dublin in Malahide. Oh. And it is phenomenal. Great course. You got to play that. Beautiful dunes, fantastic membership. And there's a lot of other courses around there. A good Portmarnock just down the road, and Portmarnock is a great golf course as well. But the Island is really cool spot. I really like that.
I think Sally from No Laying Up played there. He was talking about that place. It was great.
Yeah, definitely worth a trip. Good question. The best course.
We'll say Americans would just overlook.
A lot of them really love North Berwick. And it is a good course, but it's not under the radar. It's not like, you know, a lot of guys would have heard of it. Sorry, one sec. You know what? I'm going to go with this place, which is a pretty cool place to go to. It's actually west of Aberdeen, about 50 miles. It's a place called Ballater Golf Club, and it's actually not far from Balmoral, where the Queen has her summer residence. It's surrounded by hills, and you play a long, sort of very sand-based turf beside the water, beside the river that runs, the River Dee, which runs from the Highlands all the way out to the water in Aberdeen. It's quite short, quite tricky course, but a lot of shots where you hit it up and you can see the ball heading into the hills and then it drops down. Mm-hmm. I'm not too sure I designed it, but it's a great place to go and play, especially if you're in the Highlands and you were coming down that way. It's as sounds funny, but it's as Scottish as you're going to get because you're you're kind of surrounded by these beautiful hills. There's castles on the trip from Aberdeen to Ballater. And obviously, if the Queen, the Queen could be in Balmoral residence in the summer, when the best time to play it is.
It's I gotta get there for like, I gotta spend a lot of time there. I feel like there's like hundreds of great golf courses.
Oh, there's tons of places. I know Sully was over and we sorted him out with a game at Royal Aberdeen. And the boys took him out at night, so I think he enjoyed that.
This fall, maybe, I'm thinking. But what kind of sparked your recent kind of interest in golf course architecture? Last question, then we'll get some overrated underrated.
You know what? It was, and it's bad to say, it was just complete and utter bemusement and disappointment with some of these modern golf courses and modern designers who have tackled redesign. I don't know what the hell some of them are thinking. I don't know how they've got jobs. It's I think we're just going through a period where we don't have a lot of good designers, and for all the resources that they have, the product that they're producing is, I think, it's pretty poor.
I think it's changing, but there was so many years of bad, and I imagine you see it so prevalently when you go to like Asia.
Yeah. It's they want to put their signature on it, and I don't know what it is, and it tends to be in the form of huge hills and humps and hollows that a lot of the time look man-made and just look so false and don't bring any playability to the golf course, and they're trying to almost make it not impossible, but just trying to make it really, really hard to score. It's like, you know, I'm going to defend par all the time, but the best courses we play are the classics. You know, you want to play the golf course over and over again. Like, I think the sign of a good golf course is if someone said, well, do you want to play this for 5 days in a row? And a lot of these modern golf courses, no. But these old classics like Muirfield, Sunningdale, Carnoustie, Turnberry, you just want to play them every day for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I this fall I got to go out to, I played Sandhills. I played 63 holes in 2 days, and like since then, all I could think about is like, you know, like when you get to go see one of these great golf courses, like getting to play it multiple times, it just gets better every time.
Yeah. There's so much. So much character to it, so many different ways to play it. It changes every day. You know, it's like one of those, especially those courses. I love those courses where you go out and you think, you know, I play good, but why did I not shoot like four or five better? Because the design sort of pushed me, like it put a bit of pressure on me, as in it looked really tight off on the tees, but actually, in fact, there was lots of space there. And you know, I missed it in the wrong spot, and you can't get up and down from there. I want to get back out there and play that, and I feel like I could shoot a better score because I've played it. I understand a little bit more what the designer was thinking and how he's fooled me, almost. Can't beat that.
I feel like the really great golf courses, you almost walk off a lot of them saying like, you know what, that golf course I could really go out and shoot a low number, but you very, very rarely do.
Yes, spot on. Because it protects itself, because it just lulls you into almost sometimes a false sense of security. You think you're doing fine, and then it just hits you out of nowhere where you're like, oh, it just gets you. And it's, I think it's a little bit sad. I said to someone the other day, obviously playing Muirfield, we were talking about golf architecture, and I think that they're a great model. They what they do with their golf course there is they mold it. They don't change it. They mold it over time. So, for instance, like they'll extend a green by 4 or 5 yards, like they did on, I think, number 5. So you get a back pin position when they play the Open there. They'll make a bunker a little bit bigger, so it becomes more of a danger. They will shape a fairway a little bit more, so it feeds the player into one of the fairway bunkers. Instead of dramatically changing it, because it's a great golf course, you don't need to. You just need to slowly but surely mold it. And it's a little bit like what we have over here. We have, I don't know if you have in America, but listed buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So basically in listed buildings, you have to have, you can't really change the building too much. You can maybe change the internal parts of it, but the overall fundamental structure, things like the windows, the roof, the chimneys, the design of the building, you can't change that. You have to work with it. And I really think that these old classics should almost be like listed buildings. You know, you really have to go through a lot of, not motions, but a lot of procedure in order to change some of these, because I think a lot of people are given carte blanche for them and they destroy them, and then you can't go back and redo them.
You know how much better golf and like, and especially America would be if they had listed golf courses and they couldn't change them. I mean, it would have changed the complete course of American golf.
Oh, it would. You know, we just, it's like the golf course. The other thing is the golf course is your product. Generally, that's what people come to play. Yeah, there's experiences at a lot of clubs, and that is great. But you know, most of the time, people go there to play the golf course.
Yeah.
And
they join there because of the golf course.
Yeah, because you play the golf course, you think, actually, well, I love that. I would love to play that every week. And I think committees and designers, you know, I would love to see a designer go into a golf course and say, right, we want you to do a redesign, and him just to come back and say, you know what, you have 16 fantastic holes here. I don't think you should change much of it. What I think you should do is maybe redo some of the bunkers because they're falling in, or you know, two of the holes I would love to change a little bit because, you know, modern technology, and maybe you move the bunker that's currently out of play now another 20 yards further up. And I'd love to maybe narrow the fairway at 300 yards or something like that, or add a tree to give a little bit more character to the hole, give a sight line off the tee. Small things like that. I would love to see, and I would say hands down, the best redesign I've seen was the one at Wentworth that was done last year, but I think McGinley and Bjorn had some input into it. But McGinley is he's obviously knows the history of the golf. You know, played in the European Tours for a number of years, Ryder Cup, you name it, he's pretty much done it. But he plays, I think he's a member at Sunningdale, plays there a lot. And he really softened the changes and tried to bring back the old cult into the West Course at Wentworth, which was great to see.
Yeah, that was, I mean, the redesign a few years ago was like one of the worst redesigns like in the history of golf.
Yeah, I wasn't overly impressed because I think the original design, the one that I grew up watching Seve play the World Match Play, you know, watching guys finish 3-3-3 to finish birdie, eagle, eagle to win a match. Mm-hmm. That's the course I grew up on, where you had to run it in. That's the English Heathland classic type of golf course.
Yeah, they almost tried to make it like a a Dark Ages of America, like 1970s course.
Yeah, I don't think it's coming back. I mean, condition of it, the greens last year were absolutely first class, as good as you're going to get. And they softened the golf course, as in they took away the larger changes, the undulations that were put in it, and tried to bring back, like I say, more of the cult feel and the atmosphere with a little bit more Heathland in there, less undulation in the greens. You could bit more playability, as in you could run the ball in if you're in the rough, and a few little tall grasses off the tees, which give you a nice little sight line and a little nice little path to walk down and shape the hole a little bit more, which I thought was a good idea. Mm-hmm.
So, all right, let's get this done with some overrated, underrated. You all ready? Right. First one, golf in Ireland.
Underrated.
I think we covered it earlier, but
yeah.
Fitness.
I believe underrated.
So, like, if you took like Monty, I can't imagine him being a fitness nut ever. He would be at a disadvantage in today's game.
His attitude and his belief make up for everything. He had a great attitude and great belief, I think. I would say underrated from the fact that I just think I find it very therapeutic, as in like mentally and stress-free is a great thing to do. Maybe not gym, but just exercise in general. Mm-hmm. You know, don't care if you go and play tennis or you play football with your mates. I just think it's the best medicine you can have.
Yeah, how about him never winning in America until the senior tour? It's kind of crazy.
I don't know. It's strange because he would have the game to suit a lot of some of the courses over there because he hits it so straight and very steady. But he just, you know, he played in America. He played in Europe a lot, and you know, U.S. Open and those types of courses were built for him. He just never got the major that probably he ultimately wanted.
Yeah, the European Tour is different then too. Like, I feel like the European Tour then, they kept almost all their stars at home for the most part.
Yeah, and I think he was, you know, the world wasn't as small then. Mm-hmm. I would say, and you know, it was a lot more. European Tour was a lot more top heavy. They didn't have the depth that they have now. They had, you know, huge strength. You look at the players, undoubtedly, you know, great to the game, Langer and Woosnam and Faldo and Lyle and those guys. But yeah, I think they just like playing in Europe, and probably a lot of them had families, got kids, and they want to see I understand, you want to get back and see your family.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, air travel has just gotten so much easier. All right, backboarding. The issue of, you know, the not marking your ball, like that everybody complains about in professional golf. Like, say you're in the bunker, I'm playing, you know, I got sponsor's exemption, and I go and I don't mark my ball after I hit a sand shot, and you're in the bunker. And
I think it's overrated. It doesn't really bother me.
Yeah.
It's just something that's blown out of proportion, really, I think.
See, so it's blown out of proportion. When I play in tournaments, I feel like that backboarding's prevalent, but it's so rare for it to actually have an effect. But
yeah, if the guy chips it from 60 yards and it goes to 3 feet, and a guy's playing with me, I'm just like, well, I'm not going to wait for him to walk all the way up there and hit it. But if he's lag putted it, and he's putted up there, and he's 40 feet away, and he looks at me and says, oh, mark it, I'm like, that's fine. Doesn't bother me either way. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to probably wait if he's miles down the fairway and I'm on the greenside bunker.
Yeah. All right, last one. I don't know if you've played it. Kill Spindy.
Kill Spindy played it, yeah. Probably underrated, I'd say. It's a beautiful part of the world, East Lothian. Lovely part of the world. Lovely wee towns. And you go down there, and it's a short wee course beside the water. Bomb round there in under 3 hours because it's quite short. Just a good place to go out and play with your mates and try and shoot as low a number as possible while enjoying fantastic views and, dare I say, some sunshine and some short sleeves, if that's possible in Scotland.
When was the best month to be in Scotland?
Good question. I always get asked this a lot. Well, the other thing as well, when you come to Scotland, everybody says, oh, it must rain all the time. Right. On the west coast, it can rain for days, but on the east coast, it's a way drier. And Kilspindy, and well, basically where Muirfield is in East Lothian, that's one of the driest places in Scotland. So it's not as wet as people talk about. But the warmest time is July, August. But that's, at the same time, that's the busiest time. So the schools get off on the 1st of June. So I would say, like, end of May is not a bad time to come because it's not chaotic. The schools are still there. You get most of the run of the golf courses, and they've had enough of a growing season that conditions of the golf course are good. Mm-hmm. Or play it like late August, early September.
All right. I got to do one of those times. I don't want crowds.
Oh, if you don't like, yeah. Like, you know, everybody will just come over around about the Open, Scottish Open, start playing golf. So May time's a good time. And the other thing about May time that is a huge bonus is the longest day of the year, I believe, is the second week in June. Mm-hmm. So where I'm in Edinburgh, I'm not that far north, but it gets light here at 4:45, maybe 4:30, and it gets dark on a bright day at 10:30.
Oh my god!
So, like, if you get up early, like, say you're in Gullen, for example. Gullen's a good example. It's a little town in East Lothian, and they played the Scottish Open on Gullen Number One course
this year, right? So,
I
think so.
Two years ago, but it's back there this year. Like, if you just book it in a B&B, you can get up early, maybe make a sandwich, walk down to the first tee with your clubs, you know, a few hundred yards, tee off at, I don't know, 5:30, bomb round, in for breakfast, you know, 3 hours, in for breakfast, 8:30, have breakfast, get the train in Edinburgh, have a day in Edinburgh, come back out, and then go and tee off before a lot of people go and play after work or come off work early, try and tee off about, I'd say, like, 3:45 or something like that. And then bomb round there, a little bit of a late dinner, a few drinks, watch the sunset, you know. Play 2 rounds of golf and you're still fitted in a day out of Edinburgh. Brilliant. You know what I mean? You can do so much.
Man, I might have to move. You might have me sold. I'm going to move to the east side of Scotland.
Greatest country in the world, mate. It was voted that way. Greatest country in the world. I always tell my wife that. She's American, but she never believes me.
It's I don't know. Americans are we're stubborn, so. hey Richie, it was great having you on, and wish you the best of luck this year. You're starting in about a week and a half now.
Yeah, week and a half, Abu Dhabi, HSBC, so looking forward to it. Raring to get the short sleeves out next week in Dubai, and the shorts out, tan up the legs.
get the OB steaks tanned up.
Oh, geez, yeah. They're pretty damn white. There's no doubt about that.
All right. Well, we'll hopefully run into each other here in the season at some point, and good luck.
All right, cool. Nice talking to you.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.